Mum, why did you start travelling?
Okay, so back in 1984, I went to Stonehenge Free Festival, which was actually the last time it ever properly ran. It was its 11th year. I'd wanted to go for several years before. I went to that after Glastonbury, actually. I'd never been to Glastonbury before, so I went to Glastonbury Festival around the solstice. It was that year, and then afterwards I hitched off with my friend Joe to Stonehenge, got dropped off by this German couple on the road just outside the site, and stepped out the car, looked at the festival, and was literally,
Taken aback.
yeah, I was absolutely mesmerized. It was like one of those eureka moments, like where I just suddenly something just like clicked inside my head. I was looking at all this fantastic sight of buses and trucks and people wandering around, and it was an absolutely stunningly beautiful day. In fact, the weather was amazing that summer, and I just thought, this is what I want to do. I want to get a bus. I want to live in a bus. I want to travel around, and that's why I started traveling. So, the following year, I'd made up my mind there and then. I need to save up £1,000 and get a bus. That's what I thought. And then the following year, I went to Stonehenge again, June 1st, 1985. Stood at Washington Services in Northumberland, and I put my thumb out. I could not get a lift. Went home that evening, determined to try and get down to Stonehenge the next day and see on the news all the reports about the beanfield and how the people, the convoy, the peace convoy, had gone from Savernake Forest up to Stonehenge and had been diverted by the police under Margaret Thatcher's direction and had been trashed in a beanfield. And so on the 2nd of June, as a direct response, and I was going anyway, I hitched down to Stonehenge with a friend of mine called Paul, and from Newcastle, and we was in a tent not far from Amesbury, which is one of the nearest places to Stonehenge site, and we got moved on by the police at about 7 o'clock in the morning. I can remember looking outside at the sky, and it was just so stormy, and the clouds were rolling around all black. It was a mental kind of, it was like the gods were angry, do you know what I mean? It's like the heavens were incensed by what is now, oh, I say everyone's heard of the Beanfield, like my community well knows about the Beanfield, about the atrocities committed in that field, and I just felt as though
something wasn't happy
yeah,
about it.
really angry, like, and it's actually Stonehenge is kind of related to Mars, and Mars is like the god of war and stuff like that. It's kind of, it was, it's that's just how it felt. So yeah, I ended up going to Savernake Forest that evening. Because that's where I'd heard all the travellers had gone back to. Lord Carnarvon had let everybody go back there. Pretty sure he's Lord Carnarvon. I forget the name of the Lord now, but who owns the forest? He had been there the day before on a motorbike, pillion passenger on a motorbike, and had witnessed the atrocities performed by the police on the people in the Beanfield. For example, assaulting a pregnant woman with a child in her arms, putting in more or less everybody's windscreen in on their vehicles, mostly whilst they were sat at their steering wheel at the front there, so put in over them, and just general beatings. It came to light afterwards as well that most of the dogs that belonged to the travellers in the field were put down by vets that evening. Mm.
Yeah.
I knew that. And destroyed and all that sort of thing, which was absolutely appalling. Obviously, the dogs went mental because they were being attacked, and then, of course, they are going to fight and attack back and protect the people that they lived with and everything. So it was pretty appalling. Anyway, yeah, the 2nd of June, I ended up at Savernake Forest, and I travelled about. Well, I stayed there for a few days. Then I went home to Newcastle. And then in the autumn, there's a Magic Mushroom Festival at Cantlingstone. And I hitched down to that with another friend and see a bus for sale. And it wasn't £1,000. It was more like 300 quid. So I realised quickly that I didn't need £1,000 to buy a bus. I just needed a bus, and this one was going cheap, so I bought it and started travelling around with the guys from up there. And I think we went from Cantlingstone to Nosh's party in Wales, and then I think come back to Cantlingstone, and then started travelling off around like the home counties. A girl called Emily had made a stencil of the 8 arrows of chaos, and she was going round and spraying the 8 arrows of chaos on everybody's vehicle in the convoy. And she sprayed one on the boot of my bus, and that's how it became known as the Chaos Coach.
Yeah.
And that's how I started.
Yes. Okay.
To be fair, it was a conscious choice of actively selecting towards a lifestyle which was superior to that which I'd experienced before. Yeah. There was a great sense of community.
Mm.
And
that's what I like about it.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
A lot of people that are the same interests, you know, cruising around together. So it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It's cool that they were called the Peace Convoy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's mental how that. They're the Peace Convoy, and they got beaten up by loads of bees. So it doesn't make sense, does
it? Well, again, travellers always have had really bad publicity, and they're just being labelled as troublemakers.
Yeah,
and I think that's a lot of, that's been the root of a lot of our problem, really, has been negative press.
Yeah. I don't know, what was it? So when did you start your family? When did that start?
All right. Okay, so Lolly came along in 92. We were living in Highbroom in Tunbridge Wells when she was due to be born, and I asked for a home birth, which they said was unusual for a first baby, but they were happy to do it. I felt strongly that I just wanted to be at home to have Lolly, and it was a wonderful experience. The midwives were there. So, had any, professional help been needed, they were on hand. And that was really good. And of course, Ollie came along in 95 at Crowborough. Again, he was born at home. He was born in a bus. He was born in a Ford Super Vega. Lolly was born in an old Eccles trailer. A really nice 1950s, 1940s trailer. Was beautiful. And you were born in a 1940s Showman's trailer with a Mollycroft on it. Because we got
the Scammel.
Yeah, would be nice. I think it's in Cornwall somewhere. But, I mean, I wanted to have you all at home. There were midwives present. I didn't really have a lot of antenatal care, or which is like seeing the doctor beforehand, or postnatal care particularly, I didn't really feel the need. And
you took a big interest in herbs and stuff, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, early on, is when I started to travel. I mean, we were always like moving around a lot. We were classed as NFA, which means no fixed abode. If you go into a doctor's surgery and try and register at the practice to be seen by a doctor, and you haven't got an address, they put you down as NFA. And then you can only, at that time, we're only allowed to be a temporary resident, which had a reduced, like, limit of care for the...
You can get, like, prescription.
It was difficult to...
Well, if you were going to be moving, then they wouldn't...
Yeah, exactly. And actually, as well, I think a lot of... as I spoke to you before about the negative press, especially in the 80s around... time of the Beanfield and stuff, where we were being demonised a lot of health centres didn't really want us in there anyway and wanted us to go away and were hoping that we would. So it's kind of a bit of an animosity there. So we ended up like self-medicating. It's where I first came across herbs. And the other thing as well with our animals, veterinary surgeons are very expensive. And no one could really afford to go to the vets for things like dog worming and stuff like that. So I started off like looking at Juliet Levi, who was a traveller. She's passed away now, sadly, but she wrote lots of herbals on how to treat cats, dogs, farm animals, and also people. So I referred to her books. I also referred to David Hoffman's Holistic Herbal, and those were my kind of like herbal bibles. So we would do things like, people would be doing things like they'd accidentally hit themselves with an axe chopping up wood, or a bow saw injury because of sawing wood, or just generally that kind of thing. So infected wounds, toothache,
nasty, they're quite nasty things, but
they are
easily sort of. If you know what you're doing.
Exactly, and things like
well, things like that diarrhea, can turn nasty, can't they?
And gastro, and just like constipation, stuff like that. So the first sort of herbs I would be using, and this was because other people use it, would be like slippery elm and golden seal for like digestive problems and wounds and so on. And I became curious. That's where I got into these books I told you about. And then before you knew it, I was, studying a lot of things around becoming pregnant, because at one point I didn't think I could. So I was looking at herbals there, Mrs. Greaves, and also Culpepper as well, where I started looking at a herb called Kenopodium elidum, which is a goosefoot herb, stinking motherwort, it's called, I reckon. Yeah, and that was supposed to help like barren woman become pregnant. Now, as a result, my curiosity grew. And, eventually I became pregnant with Lolly, which was brilliant. And then whilst I was pregnant, you have to be so careful what you do and what you take. I was being careful to avoid things like sage and thyme and rosemary, because all of those herbs can actually send a pregnant woman into, like, labour. And so you can lose children before they're ready to be born, like that. So I was very, very careful with what I was taking, and also if I was stressed, I would take valerian, because that's all right for a pregnant, well, it was all right for me to take. It got to the point where a lot of people started coming to me and asking me for advice, especially where, like, pregnancies, threatened miscarriages. I'd stopped all you three. I used herbs to stop losing you, because I thought I was going to lose Lolly at one point, and Ollie, and you. And so I used herbs to stop miscarriages. Mm. A lot of women came to me asking me for this advice on that because they would be threatening a miscarriage, they wouldn't be able to get to a doctor's. Or the, in those days, we didn't have mobile phones either, do you know what I mean? You'd be out in the middle of nowhere.
On your own.
Yeah, and you'd have to treat people. It'd be easier to treat people than it was to try and get them to hospital or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and then young children as well, things like the normal complaints like head lice, you know, teething,
yeah,
that kind of thing. Yeah. And then after a while, I decided I'd like to like learn more, and so I did a degree in herbal medicine, and now I've got that. So that was with the School of Herbal Medicine, which became the School of Phytotherapy later, which is now sadly no more, but did leave the College of Practitioners of Phytotherapy behind. So that's like a professional body that herbalists belong to that was there. That was Hein and Annette Zylstra, Z-E-Y-L-S-T-R-A, Zylstra, Hein and Annette Zylstra, who set that up. And that was brilliant, a brilliant initiative of theirs to spread the word really about herbal medicine. So yeah, that's where the family started. That's where the herbal medicine got quite seriously, you know, involved. And it's interesting because Annette wrote me a letter once. As I wrote her a letter to say that I was so sorry to hear that the school had gone to the wall. It was money, basically. I forget the right term for it, but it liquidated because it had gone bankrupt, basically. I wrote her a letter to say how sorry I was, and I hoped that she was okay, and that I had the utmost respect for her and Hein, and that that I think that they had single-handedly put herbal medicine on the map, certainly in Britain, if not in Europe. Yeah, she wrote me a lovely letter back saying how much comfort she'd got from my letter, and she said she hoped that I would have a good future with herbal medicine. And she said herbal medicine is like a plant that grows in your heart, you just can't stop it from growing. And I just thought it was a lovely thing to say, and she's absolutely right. And you've all been brought up, none of you have been, apart from Lolly, who had three vaccinations, the triple, none of you have been vaccinated. I took you to a homeopath in Tunbridge Wells, and they prescribed homeopathy for you in case you did get any of the, it's like called homeopathic immunisations, basically. I got to the point with you, when you were born, I wouldn't even let them do the heel prick test, which is the phenylketonuria, PKU test, and it's also to check for dwarfism as well. I wouldn't even let them do that because it meant they would have to stick a needle in your heel and take a bit of blood. And when they did it to Ollie, he cried.
Yeah.
And that's a plaster on it. Aww. It was well sad.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, cheers.
Yeah. That's all right. Well, you all turned out all right anyway, so. Yeah,
turned out good.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are your best memories then?
Oh, my best memories have got to be when you guys were born, for sure. Without a shadow of a doubt. And just when the sun is shining and your friends around and you're sitting around a campfire and you're drinking tea, or you might be having a drop of Guinness or something like that.
Yeah, I've got
that.
Some pretty good memories from Crowborough. You know, when we went to Crowborough?
Yeah.
And we were outside that one night. We stayed outside and
that's
had
right.
a bonfire.
That was funny, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a good night. And
Ollie said, Mummy, I feel sick, didn't he?
Yeah.
Mummy, I feel sick. I said, shut up and eat your dinner. And he had one more mouthful and was sick all over the plate, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. I've done that before.
I felt pretty bad, even though it might not have looked like that at the time, because I was laughing.
Yeah.
But, You know what I mean?
I thought you used the pain.
That was to do with herbal medicine as well, wasn't it? Because I used to have to go to seminars, didn't I, at the school at Bodle Street Green.
Yeah.
And then later on in at Battle, I had to go there. And so we would go off all together, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
While I went and I did my seminar and caught up on that kind of thing. Or exams. Sometimes I'd have to go and sit a rake of examinations or whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Crowborough. It's nice you went to Crowborough because you weren't born. You were conceived probably there.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Because I was left Crowborough expecting you, quite heavily pregnant. That was fun. That was me and you. Obviously, I was pregnant with you.
Yeah.
I think Ollie was strapped in the lorry in the Scammel in the drive in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
And I drove the Scammel down with the showman's trailer and the transit van A-framed behind it. It was like 72 foot long. We bent in two places and
so
we drove
cool.
down to, we drove down from Crowborough to Brighton like that. And that's also when we left Basingstoke and came to Cornwall, because we came to Cornwall to see the 1999 eclipse, which was the 11th of August that year, as I always remember because it's my best mate Alex's birthday.
So is that when there was a festival here? That eclipse, was it?
Yeah.
The Lizard Festival.
They had a Lizard Festival here. Yeah, right where we are now.
Yeah.
It's actually quite kind of like...
It's pretty mental, isn't it?
It is like a full circle. It's almost like... It's quite cool.
Yeah.
That I did come here and look at the festival, and then we ended up living round here. And now we're going to live right where that festival was. I mean, the reason we came to Cornwall was for the eclipse. So it's quite cosmic, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty mental.
So, my best memories are like travelling down the road in great big long convoys. I loved that as well.
Going to festivals.
Finding new places.
Didn't you get free
festivals?
Free festivals because you were
years ago, they didn't charge. But now they've been completely commercialised. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and now there's a price tag.
Top dollar, and you've got to pay thousands to have a pitch there if you want to
sell
stuff as a business.
It's just like so different to what it was.
Yeah.
Although there are, I mean, apparently they're going to have a Stonehenge free festival this year.
This is the first time they've actually let people back, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not going to be on the old site.
No.
It won't be where those like burial mounds are and all the tumuli or whatever. It's going to be 8 miles away. But at least it's going to be a Stonehenge free festival.
There'll be a thing
festival.
Happening there as well. Do you know what I mean? There'll be the festival will be 8 miles away, but there'll still be
people
zooming
down,
to the
monument at the Henge. And take it in Stonehenge. Though, when they started letting us back in again, I used to drag you along, didn't I?
When they
let us back, didn't they? And you were allowed to go in between a certain time and. Till a certain time, but I mean, it's very controlled.
Yeah.
But you know, Stonehenge free festival as it was back in the '80s. You kids weren't around. Once they started letting us back to the monument around 2000, and you were all young, like we'd go up here and there and check
going
that
a couple
out.
Times and it was,
yeah.
Yeah.
And that I enjoyed that as well.
It's nice. It's a cool place.
Yeah.
The whole like mounds. Where people were meant to be buried or something rude like that.
Yeah.
Don't know much about it.
Yeah. I just love it. Like, great long journeys in rigs.
Mm.
The thrill of the move and the thrill of the new place. And just the excitement of it all. And, and that sense of community. I mean, that's all being quite, like, rinsed out of the scene.
Definitely.
The scene's so much different now. You find somewhere, you hang on to it, which is how come we ended up on Coverack Car Park for 12 years, nearly 12 years. If it hadn't have been for you turning 18 and leaving college, and key things like parish council being in control, where they don't have to give so much of a care about your personal circumstances and what have you. Things like not being able to defend our position very easily because legal aid system. Scene was totally different. Obviously, we had some savings They're what your nan left us, which meant we had to pay for our own legal advice, which was just puts justice out of your pocket, out of your reach. You just can't do it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and things like Lord Avebury dying on the on Valentine's Day, 2016. He died on Valentine's Day. We got given a paperwork to quit on the 15th. And the reason I mentioned Lord Avebury is he was our advocate in the House of Lords. The House of Lords is the highest court in the land. He's the one who used to stand up for refugees and travellers and so on and so forth. And you can bet your life that he knew all about us down on Coverack car park.
Yeah,
Coverack being such a high profile place. Mm. I mean, it's just one of those places, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a holiday resort, but the rich and the famous use, do you know what I mean? And basically it's high profile.
Yeah, it's really high
profile. It's gone, like, even in the last 10 years, it's changed so much. Mm. Certainly since the 80s, Cornwall's changed so much, which is why we're in Cornwall, because it's more relaxed than the home counties. But the upcountry ideas are following
They're
us.
They're coming this way. Yeah.
It's all changing like that. Yeah. So you have that situation where people who were born in Coverack can't afford to live there.
Yeah,
because it's the houses are priced right out of there. So more than half of Coverack is empty unless there's a holiday maker in there or their second home user is there at the time. Yeah, exactly, and it's a ghost town. Well, we used to put a pulse in that village. Do you know what I mean? Because you went through the school and so on and so forth, and we're there when business is low. Mm. You know, when no one else is going to the pub or the caf or the shop, we are. Do you know what I mean? And so these key things happened, and as a result, we ended up, it did feel like a terrorist attack, more like us leaving there. It was, as I've described already.
Yeah.
So,
it was pretty,
I can't remember where we started there, but we kind of finished here. I can't remember what they got. Oh, my best memories.
Oh,
that's
it.
We're just so isolated, and that makes me sad. It makes me sad. I know there's a lot of people, they moved out of Britain. They went abroad to places like Orgiva in Spain. And there are places in the world where it's a lot more relaxed. But Britain, it's tiny. And it's
pretty fascist.
Pretty fascist. Seems that way, doesn't it?
Well, some people are like that. You're going to get them sorts everywhere.
But true.
They're the kind of people that will put themselves in positions where they can get their views heard and like, because they care about, you know. Oh, it's hard to explain. Like, relaxed people aren't going to get a job as a politician and start being like, everyone needs to be more relaxed. If you see what I mean, like, whereas someone who has more of an extreme view, like, would probably want to be heard about it.
And that's because
they think something's going majorly wrong, and then they'll get up there and then just, don't know.
They're more likely to be aggressively pursuing their career, aren't they?
Yeah.
Than just somebody who's got more of a relaxed, more balanced attitude, potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, the situation is, I mean, I do consider ourselves almost like a dying breed, almost. But then I reflect across the history of travelling and gypsies and so on. I mean, because, like, Bowers is a Romany gypsy name. And I know that because I spoke to Jake Bowers, who was the editor of Travellers Times, who started Travellers Times.
Yeah.
And I met him at an AGM for a committee. It was a forum that Ginny Harrison-White set up. Who was key to, like, in the inception of the Cornwall Traveller Education Support Services. And she set up this forum, and she had, like, a couple of AGMs. And I actually spoke at the first one when we first got to Cornwall. I made a speech.
Yeah.
And Angus Murdoch was there as well. He's a professor of law and also traveller. And he was also there, and he gave a speech too. And I have a problem with my microphone.
Oh,
Thank you. So, he told me it's a Romany Gypsy name. So, I mean, because I often wonder, why did I start travelling? Was it just because I stepped out on that beautiful summer's day in 1984 and looked at Stonehenge and went, I want a bus? Or is it because there's some deeper,
yeah, you clearly like, triggered roots. Something inside you that yeah. was just like...
That was, yeah, felt, yeah, right. exactly. Yeah, yeah. There was just this perfect harmony about the moment and this like, truth about it all. And I do believe that we are of gypsy blood, and it would not surprise me in the slightest to find out that we come from, like, Romany gypsy blood at all. And because the thing is, the persecution of gypsies and travellers over the years has been so intense that it actually didn't do you any favours to declare that you were a gypsy or a traveller to people, because you don't know who you're talking to. Do you know what I mean? And it meant life or death. Literally meant life or death.
Because it was scary to people back then, like this whole idea of people, you know, going around being themselves and not necessarily caring as much about, you know, what other people thought about them and stuff, and just like we're living for free and, you know, weren't going to take no for an answer and stuff like that. I think people were a bit scared by it. So you can see why, you know, people were just a bit like, didn't know what to do about it and just took to just being, you know, like sort of, like defensive in a way, where like they would just treat you like you were a bad person, where they just didn't actually know what you were about necessarily.
Exactly.
So they were just scared, really.
There is a fear of the unknown, and then there's an opportunity for someone to come in and try, and you can get misinformed.
Yeah.
So if you don't know about something, you can become misinformed about it.
Yeah.
Which again goes back to the propaganda thing, and it goes back to the 8 stages of genocide, where you start off with classifying people, separating them out, using the media for propaganda, polarisation of the group that you are trying to persecute or whatever, and then, you know, it's a long, slow process, do you know what I mean? And it is open to that. And for some reason, gypsies and travellers have been fully subjected to that treatment over time. Like gypsies
mental.
And travellers were also, like, obviously if you go back to the Holocaust and all, it was also disabled people, it was lesbians and gays, and it was
anyone who would have a slightly different view
if you go to the one that happened in Cambodia, they were persecuting people that were intelligent, that were doctors, and they wanted to get rid of them because they just wanted people to be like
workers. It's amazing how they're still going by a lot of these laws where like, you know, gypsies aren't accepted and stuff like that. When you're coming from like 100 years ago, women were barely recognised as upstanding members of the community.
Indeed.
And it's like, what the fuck?
Well, that's still kind of in there, isn't it? I saw something the other day, somebody posted up about... it was Karen Lawton actually, and she posted it up, and it was about all these books on the shelf. They wanted to know how many books had no male characters in, and only about 6 books got took out of this library. And then they wanted to know how many books didn't mention women.
How many books were there to start with? 1,000?
There wasn't that many.
There was
many.
Like 1,000
books. Probably a couple, I don't know.
Or something. But by the end of it, there was like 20 books left that actually had women that had aspirations in it. And
so
actually
women,
spoke in
exactly.
the books
so
and weren't relying on princes and princes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you might not, it won't be so blatant as like segregation where women have to be on one side and men on the other or whatever. Like it still goes on, I suspect, in some
and girls. Toilets and changing
but
rooms.
It's on a subtle level, it's still going on, you know. And
and
so they removed 6 for if there are no male characters, there's 176 for no female characters in
the
book.
Up until not long ago, it was called like police men, and they weren't called police officers, even stuff like that. Like,
that's right,
people just grow up assuming that, like, assuming things just because of what they see on TV and hear on the radio.
That's right. And they're still like, you know, and the rest of the books were like, take all the books out where the women have, the only role is that they're a princess. So there's another rake of books took out. And then, you know, yeah. And like all the men were all like heroes and doing stuff. But the women were like, unless they had like a fairy or a mouse to help them. Do you know what I mean?
They didn't do
it. But just the damsel in distress or whatever.
Yeah, all the time.
Disempowering women.
Sitting there waiting for something to change.
Yeah.
Instead of making the change herself. Sort of thing.
So it still goes on. And the challenge is still there. And what we have to do is we have to carry on doing what we know is right.
Yeah, just sort of opening people's eyes.
Absolutely.
To who's actually the, you know, the bad people in this. Mm. You know, the people who are just trying to live how they want to live. Yeah. Or the people that are good at trying to control the people are trying to live how they want to live.
Because gypsies and travellers, it's not just all about the ones that were persecuted. And like, and people, you say gypsy to a lot of people, they'll think about the ones that were murdered in the concentration camps.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. But the there are a lot of really highly accomplished gypsies and travellers in the world, and like, you got Charlie Chaplin was one, you got David Essex is a gypsy, or actually I think he prefers to be called a traveller, to be fair. I think I read somewhere that he didn't like being called a gypsy, he liked to be called a traveller. Yeah. Anyway, you have people in high up places, very highly accomplished, that are gypsies and travellers. And so we're not all about victims, and we're not all about sites that are left in a mess or something like that, or police roadblocks and confrontation.